Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Their feud has become the stuff of legend, setting the mark against which all their quarrels are measured. But how much of what we know or think we know about the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys is true, and how much is legendary? In this week's show, Talking History's Eileen Dugan discusses the Hatfields and the McCoys with her guest, Altina Waller. And after that, Jeffrey Paisley will offer us his thoughts on the recent popularity of the founding father, John Adams. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week we recall the adoption of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which guaranteed American women the right to vote. The date was August 20th, 1920, and it was a major milestone in women's centuries-long struggle for political equality. Some date the origins of the American suffrage movement to the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York in July 1848, where 300 women gathered to demand political, social, and economic equality. Others focus on the Progressive Era, the 30 years or so before the adoption of the 19th Amendment, and the heroic efforts of suffragists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Carrie Chapman Catt, and Alice Paul, as well as women's patriotic work during World War I. In 1918, as the proposed amendment was being debated across the country, President Woodrow Wilson asked, "We have made partners of women in this war. Shall we admit them only to a partnership of suffering and sacrifice, and not to a partnership of privilege and right?" As feminist Crystal Eastman observed, however, in the aftermath of the suffrage crusade, men are saying, perhaps, "Thank God this everlasting women's fight is over." But women, if I know them, are saying, "Now at last we can begin."
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, 50 years after the radio bulletin that rocked the nation with the news of her death, thousands of Argentinians recently mourn the passing of their beloved Evita. They filed past the black marble crypt of Maria Eva Duarte de Perón, Argentina's most famous first lady, to mark the anniversary of her death on July 26, 1952. Workers, the elderly, and others wore lapel pins and national colors and left bouquets at the gravesite in Buenos Aires. As one mourner put it, "She's not Madonna, she's not the Hollywood film, she's not the musical. She's much more than that." But her memory continues to spark heated debate. To many in the crowd, Evita represented social justice, generosity, love, and dedication to the poor. To others, she is still seen as a partner in a corrupt dictatorship motivated only by self-interest. Born into rural poverty, Evita was a screen actress before she married strongman Juan Perón in 1944. Together, they dominated Argentine politics for 7 years before her death from cancer at the age of 33. This is Talking History. As promised, we now turn to the Hatfields and the McCoys. Talking History's Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, separates fact from fiction for us with her guest, Altina Waller.
The feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys of West Virginia is the stuff of American legend. In our minds, this feud spanned decades and killed dozens. But how does the legend of the Hatfields and McCoys correspond to reality? Is the story of this feud merely a curious tale, or does it actually reveal something about a society undergoing change? With us today to examine America's most famous feud is Dr. Altina L. Waller, professor of history at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Waller is the author of Feud, Hatfields, McCoys, and Social Change in Appalachia, 1860 to 1900. Welcome, Dr. Waller.
Hello, how are you, Eileen?
Okay, who were the Hatfields and the McCoys before their feud began? I mean, where did they live, for example?
Well, the Hatfields and McCoys were part of two communities in southern West Virginia and northeastern Kentucky. And in fact, the Tug River Valley, which was the site of the feud, was the boundary between Kentucky and West Virginia. And it was in the post-Civil War period, it was a very remote part of the country They didn't have, at the beginning of this period, railroads or a lot of stores, or coal mining had not yet come to the area. So it was a rural farming community, very much like rural communities you would find in many other parts, and in the South, in Virginia, in New England, and in western Massachusetts, and Vermont, and New Hampshire. Except that, of course, they lived in a very, very mountainous, very beautiful, actually, place with mountains. And this provided a certain amount of isolation from the rest of the country.
The feud, some would say, began around the Civil War era. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's been the assumption of many people, because there was an incident where Asa Harmon McCoy was killed by a group of guerrillas in the Confederacy led by Devil Ants Hatfield, who was the leader of the Hatfields. And he was also a soldier in the Civil War. He did desert and then formed his own guerrilla company in the mountains in order to protect his community. And Asa Harmon was one of the very few northern loyalists in the Tug Valley community. Most of the McCoy family and the Hatfields and most of the community, indeed, were loyal to the Confederacy. So Asa Harmon was seen as a traitor, and he got into trouble, and he was killed, and it was never proved who did it, but most people assumed it was this guerrilla company led by Devil Ants Hatfield. However, neither side ever claimed that this had anything to do with the later conflict, which erupted 13 years later. Nothing happened between the Civil War and the outbreak of the feud, and neither the McCoys or the Hatfields said it had anything to do with the feud. So I really don't think that it really was the precipitating event of the feud.
When did the feud begin then?
Well, officially, you know, the first event we can identify that really started the violence is the 1878 incident in which Randall McCoy thought that one of the Hatfields, not Devil Lance himself, but his cousin, I believe, had stolen his hog. Well, hogs were, people laugh about this if you start over a hog, but of course, in any rural culture, hogs, cattle are extremely important and extremely valuable. So he accused this cousin, Floyd Hatfield, of stealing his hog. And there was actually a court trial. In our mythology, he would have picked up his gun and gone and shot a few people, but he didn't. He went to the local justice of the peace and demanded justice, and there was a trial over this event. And the jury was composed of six McCoys and six Hatfields, and Randall McCoy lost. They said, no, the hog did in fact belong to the Hatfield. So that what this was the first event, 1878, and then there were a series of things culminating in 1882. However, I think that another event that one might consider, and this is what came to me after I started studying this, was in 1872, Devil Ants Hatfield had sued someone named Perry Klein over 5,000 acres of land. And now we can talk a minute about who Perry Klein was. But this was a very important case because Devil Ants Hatfield really needed more land, and he sued again Perry Klein in a court of law. He didn't, you know, go fight for it with his gun, and he won. So apparently the court thought that he had rights to this land. And in the later phases of the feud, Perry Klein becomes very important. So I would argue in some deeper analysis of the feud, probably the 1872 land case between Klein and Hatfield could be considered the beginning of the feud.
You've already mentioned a couple of times the Hatfields or the McCoys going to court. Were you surprised to find how often either side would appeal to the authorities?
Well, I have to say yes. When I first started the research, I mean, when I told people I was doing research on the Hatfields and McCoys, I mean, real historical research, not just legend and newspaper accounts, they said, well, how can you possibly do that since they couldn't read and write and they solved all their problems with guns? Shot first and ask questions later was what some people said to me. They said, you just can't do research. And I said, well, maybe not, but I'll try. So I went to the courthouses in Logan County and Pike County, and there were all the records. I mean, these people were obviously very legalistic, legally minded. And in terms of their land records, their deeds were there back to the beginning of the settlement. They went to court. They had a county court, and their court days were some of the most important events in their lives, in their political, social, economic lives. And they wrote things down. They kept very good records. In fact, I found better records in West Virginia and Kentucky than I found in some of my research areas in Massachusetts and New York. The myth is that they were, you know, a primitive people who didn't care about written records or things like that is completely false.
We always imagined that in this feud it was all the Hatfields on one side, all the McCoys on the other. Did you find this to be the case?
No, that was a surprising. There were several surprising things about the feud, and one of them was the fact that more than half the Hatfield group were not Hatfields in the sense that they were not related, closely related to the leader of the Hatfield family, Devil Anse. And on the other side, the McCoys, the same way. And in fact, there was a lot of intermarriage. One of the things you have to remember about this region of southern Appalachia is that the names Hatfield and McCoys were extremely common, like Smith and Jones in the north. Imagine that if you said there was a feud between the Smiths and the Jones in the north. I mean, that's so many people that it's almost the whole community. And so Smiths and Jones are intermarried a lot, and so with the Hatfields and McCoys. There was a lot of intermarriage. There was a lot of relationships. So it was very hard to sort out, but it was very clear that they were not all on one side. And then the other interesting thing is that only a few people were involved in the feud. I think I identified about 80 or 90 individuals, somewhere in that range, out of the whole two big counties in, you know, which is like 1% of the population. I mean, it was certainly not a whole everybody in one family, everybody in the other family fighting each other.
When did outsiders begin to get involved in this feud?
Well, in what I call the second phase, one of the things that I uncovered in my research was there are really two different feuds. I mean, to say the feud is a little bit misleading because the first phase I've already talked about, which you can say started with the land case or started with the hog dispute, and ended with the killing of Ellison Hatfield on an election day, an election day celebration in 1882. And that essentially was one phase of the feud. And then there was 5 years in which absolutely nothing happened. People kind of settled down and wanted to forget it, hoped they could, you know, put it behind them. And then 5 years later in 1887, the state of Kentucky decided they would essentially revived the feud by reissuing the warrants against the Hatfields. And the whole thing started up again and with much more enhanced violence, many more people killed, more violence going on. And so the state of Kentucky essentially got involved and revived it. So I said to myself, what is going on here? This is a very strange phenomenon. That in the first phase of the feud at the state level, and the newspapers and the state government seemed totally uninterested in anything that went on in Appalachian Kentucky. It wasn't in any newspaper. Nobody really cared. But after 1887, suddenly they cared.
Why do you think they did begin to care?
Well, that's that was the focus of a lot of my research. And what seemed to be happening was there had been an economic depression in the region, and the state was thinking about development. And one of the ways of developing their state was to see if there was coal to be mined, because in other regions in Appalachia, coal had begun to be discovered, and coal was an extremely important resource for the industrialization of the whole country. It was in very high demand. So the state paid a geologist to go searching all around the mountain parts of Appalachian Kentucky and see if there was coal that they could exploit. And the report came out in this five-year period when nothing was going on in the feud. And the report said that right in the Tug Valley, right where the Hatfields and McCoys lived, there was these extremely rich deposits of coal that could be developed. And a railroad, the Norfolk and Weston, decided in this five-year period that it looked so good for making money by shipping timber and coal, because timber was really the beginning to be shipped out too, that they would build a railroad. And the news came about that a railroad was about to be built, so suddenly the land values in the Tug Valley shot up dramatically. And there was a whole different situation economically. Suddenly the state was very interested in this region and decided that they wanted to do something about its development.
And why did it then become more violent?
Well, I think it could have happened in different ways, but because of the previous feud, the original feud, which nobody paid any attention to, which was a relatively mild conflict, but one of the victims in that conflict had been this man named Perry Klein, who had been a neighbor of Ans Hatfield. Hatfield, remember, had sued him for 5,000 acres of land. He lost the land. In other words, 5,000 acres was a huge amount in that day and age. And he was basically impoverished by losing this land. So he went off to Pikeville, which was the nearest large town in that county, and he managed to do okay as he was a druggist, and he was then he became a lawyer. But he never lost this idea that he would regain his land, and he never stopped hating the Hatfields. So in 1887, he had gotten friendly with the new governor of Kentucky because he'd been on his campaign team and all this. So he said, well, you know, these Hatfields, they're never going to let you, and he's talking to the governor now, develop this country because they own all the land there, and they're really nasty people, and they're very violent people, and you need to do something about it. And the governor said, oh, well, gee, what can I do? And he said, well, you know, there was this feud 5 years ago, and they were actually, they killed some of the McCoys, and, you know, why don't you reissue the indictments, offer rewards, send in troops? And so that's what the governor did. And so this combination, it's a very complex picture, the combination of the personal revenge motive of Perry Klein and the access he had to the governor and the interest. I mean, he couldn't have done that if the state thought there was no, you know, nothing to gain by doing this. But they were thinking about this coal development. And so he was able to reach the governor at just a very important point in the economic development plans of the state of Kentucky.
How did the feud end?
Actually went to the Supreme Court, went because the governor appointed a posse to go to cross the border from Kentucky into West Virginia, and they went in and they arrested 9 Hatfields, not Devil Ants himself, but his group, and they took them back to Pikeville, Kentucky to stand trial. The governor of West Virginia got involved and said, you can't do that. You've kidnapped, you know, West Virginia citizens, and we have an extradition process, and this is violation of that process. So he went to the federal courts. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically upheld Kentucky and said, you know, go ahead and try them. It doesn't matter how they got to your jail. Even if you kidnapped them, it doesn't matter that you can try them because they're in your jail now. So they were all tried. Several were sent to prison of the 9. One, they decided, had to hang. So there was the last actual hanging execution in Kentucky was Ellison Mounts, who was a Hatfield member of the Hatfield group. And thousands of people, 1890, I think it was February of 1890, thousands of people gathered to see this hanging. But essentially, that was the end. Nothing really happened after that. The place, the Tug Valley community was developed. In fact, Devil Ants was forced to sell all his land through a whole series of things that happened to him, and he had to move away from the valley. He never went to jail, never was caught. But he did lose all his land, and it was right through there. The railroad was built. Coal began to be mined.
So all in all, the feud only lasted, what, about
12 years.
12 years, as opposed to what we usually think is it spanning decades.
Well, some people ask me, is it still going on today? No, it's not. It ended long ago. It ended in 1890. So I think the timing that it was really so short in duration, even in both the phases of the feud I've talked about, that it was not really family violence. I think it was economic conflict that was the root of the feud. And so I think those things are in the mythology of the feud. I think the first conflict, you can say, okay, so the second conflict was brought about by the governor wanting to develop the region. What about that first part? And that was also economic in a way because there was a classic conflict of not very much land, especially in a region that had very mountainous land, so it was difficult to farm. And these families were having like 10, 13 children. I think the McCoy family, Randall McCoy, had 16 children. Devil Ants had 13, and these were typical. And so there was literally a clash here. You had too many people, too little land. They didn't want to move because they did like their community, so there was this sort of, a lot did leave, but a lot wanted to stay in the mountains. And they were going to be in trouble anyway. Even without the coal development, there was going to be this problem. And what they did to try to remedy it was to go into the timber business and supply timber for people. And there was already economic conflict over that issue. And that, I think, is what caused the first part of the feud.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Waller.
Okay. Thank you. I enjoyed being on your show.
We have been talking with Dr. Altina L. Waller, professor of history at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Feud, Hatfields, McCoys, and Social Change in Appalachia, 1860 to 1900.
only in part the result of David McCullough's best-selling biography, John Adams' merits are being extolled across the land. There are even plans for erecting a monument to the Founding Father on the Washington Mall. University of Missouri historian Jeffrey Paisley is troubled by the Adams craze, however, and wants to set the record straight.
The sudden stardom of John Adams, soon to be a major monument, forms one of the wonders of the present age. As David McCullough's mammoth biography rides the bestseller list and collects its obligatory Pulitzer Prize, the second president's grimacing face is on display in locations he could not have imagined. Airport gift shops, the aisles of Target, even coffee tables in suburban Kansas City. Though long popular with historians for the wonderfully honest, acerbic, and introspective sources he left behind, Adams is tough to feature as a 21st century icon. David McCullough's claim for Adams' fame is that what Adams wrote dealt with the ideas and ideals that are the basis of our whole way of life, of our society as Americans. But while it's true that Adams played a powerful role in bringing about American independence, the political values of the new republic that emerged from independence were not John Adams' values. As his fellow Americans thrilled to the democratic, egalitarian message of Paine's common sense, Adams sat down to write a rebuttal. After the Revolution, Adams spent much of his time on the wrong side of history, railing against the ideas and ideals that became the basis of American life and politics, especially were the ones revolving around a word that Adams rarely used positively, democracy. As our first vice president, Adams was a laughingstock, invited to two or three cabinet meetings tops in 8 years. He spent a lot of his time proposing and defending ideas that mercifully did not become part of our political tradition. He wanted royal titles and life tenures for senators and chief executives. He wanted the open maintenance of an aristocracy, maybe even turning the Senate into an aristocracy. Adams was even willing to consider the idea of calling the chief executive a king instead of a president. While not the avowed monarchist of Jeffersonian propaganda, Adams worried that American constitutions were too heavily skewed toward democracy. It was far better to err in the other direction. The people were as unjust, tyrannical, brutal, barbarous, and cruel as any king or senate, and more prone to intemperance and excess, he wrote. Democracy without an aristocracy or monarchy to keep it in check would lead to vice and corruption, while the reverse would be merely unjust, not a huge problem as far as Adams was concerned. As president, Adams signed and used what remains the nation's only peacetime sedition law, one that was openly intended to suppress and silence a nascent opposition party, the one led by Thomas Jefferson. This was coupled with the Alien Acts, the nation's first crackdown on politically suspicious immigrants, in a case where the dangers they seemed to pose were not that they would blow up buildings, but only that they were supporting the opposition political party. Whatever his other virtues, John Adams stands out rather boldly in our history as the only president not dealing with armed rebellion who got to have his critics in the press and politics arrested, jailed, or driven into hiding. Many others, from Washington, Nixon to Clinton, would have enjoyed similar privileges, but did not seek them. As little sense as it seems to make, the origins of the Adams craze are not all that mysterious. It seems to be the byproduct of a celebrity culture that is coming to dominate American history publishing as thoroughly as it does most other aspects of our society. Celebrity historian David McCullough cast his gaze on Adams, and his rotundity, as Adams was known in his day, suddenly became both a national hero and a corporate profit center. McCullough breezes over most of Adams's politics in favor of extolling Adams as a person, full of life, high-spirited, affectionate, loyal to friends, a kind and dedicated father and husband. McCullough and a majority of Congress think that Adams has been unfairly maligned and decry his shameful neglect by earlier generations of Americans who failed to put the big hulking memorial in Washington that Adams allegedly deserves and is now being planned. What McCullough and Congress failed to realize was that there was a reason for earlier generations of Americans not turning John Adams into a monument of democracy. Earlier generations of Americans actually understood what Adams was all about.
You've been listening to Jeffrey Paisley, professor of history at the University of Missouri, and the author of The Tyranny of Printers, Newspaper Politics in the Early American Republic. And for those of you wanting to actually stand on the ground where John Adams trod and even lived, Joey Skidmore tells you where you can do just that.
The Adams National Historical Park is located in Quincy, Massachusetts, about 10 miles south of Boston. The park comprises 11 historic structures and a cultural landscape of almost 14 acres, which tell the story of five generations of the Adams family that included two presidents and first ladies, three U.S. ministers, historians, and writers. The site features John Adams' birthplace, but it also includes the old house where John and Abigail Adams lived for most of their married life and where four generations of their descendants continued to reside after their death. You can also see the United First Parish Church, where both presidents and first ladies are entombed in the family crypt. All of this and more awaits you at the Adams National Historical Park in Quincy, Massachusetts.
And finally, we call to your attention a major museum exhibit, where you can learn more about Egyptian ideas on death. The exhibit, The Quest for Immortality, Treasures of Ancient Egypt, is at the National Gallery of Art and runs through October 14th before departing Washington for a multi-city tour of the United States and Canada. Quest explores ancient Egyptians' notions about death and the afterlife using 115 artifacts, the largest collection of Egyptian antiquities ever loaned by Egypt for exhibition in North America. Some objects have never been exhibited. Others have never left Egypt. The highlight of the exhibit is a recreation of the tomb of Thutmose III, an Egyptian ruler in the 15th century BC. The tomb's walls are covered with a replica of a pictorial guidebook instructing pharaohs on how to achieve immortality in the afterlife. The guidebook describes a pharaoh's 12-hour journey through the night, a metaphor for eternal life that ends at sunrise when he is resurrected as the sun god Re. For more information on The Quest for Immortality, Treasures of Ancient Egypt, contact the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
Just remember that death is not